Are there alternatives for financing critical infrastructure, healthcare, and other public projects that is missing from Canada's election debate? How and why was the role of the Bank of Canada altered in the 1970s, and how did that lead to the current financial woes facing the country? How has the public banking model fared in North Dakota, Costa Rica, Germany, and other jurisdictions around the world? What was truly behind the inflationary pressures Western countries have seen since the 1970s? How has monetary policy since the 1970s been used to transfer wealth to elite interests in Canada and around the world? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we examine the potential for public banking to rescue Canadian and other economies from economic ruin. Our guests are Herb Wiseman of the Canadian-based Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform, and Ellen Hodgson Brown, book author and founder of the Public Banking Institute. On today's program, Prescription for Prosperity, the Public Banking Remedy. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 18th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. No one bats 1,000, but according to Ignacio Chapella, a microbiologist from UC Berkeley in California, the biotech industry has utterly failed. He says they've only come up with two genetically modified traits in 40 years, despite fouling our air, water, and soil, while genetically engineering our food to withstand copious amounts of toxic chemicals. Chapella points out that GMO scientists have become like priests with a central dogma that specific traits are determined by certain genes. Chapella and others, like Bruce Lipton, a PhD biologist, don't believe that DNA is a master molecule that determines a person or plant's traits. He and those who share his rare viewpoint understand that environment plays a bigger role. That comes from the article, Microbial Biologist Says Biotech is Like a Religion and It is Failing, by Christina Sarek. Posted September 16th, originally appearing at naturalsociety.com. Turkey practiced since many years a suspicious open-door policy towards refugees, amassing hundreds of thousands in fully financed and well-organized refugee camps. During a recent visit to Bodrum, Turkey, that's a Turkish transit city to Kos, Greece, I was told, to better control the flow of refugees, i.e. the exit from Turkey, Erdogan's government has eliminated most refugee camps along the Turkish border, shifting them to huge camps near Istanbul. These camps are part of a long-term strategy to justify the creation of quote-unquote safe havens in northern Syria, which eventually would serve the invasion of NATO and their terrorist proxies, ISIS-Daesh. Once in the country, they would be able to move towards Damascus to carry out the long-planned regime change, toppling the government of democratically elected Bashar al-Assad. As a parallel or backup plan, the unholy alliance between Washington, NATO, and Turkey agreed to open Turkey's floodgates for refugees, actually promoting the exodus to gain free rein in the safe havens and to build up a mass of refugees, most of whom want to flee to Germany, which in the right moment could be let go and cause the right pressure or destabilization effects in Europe. That comes from the article, Refugees as Weapon and Germany Shifting Alliances, by Peter Koenig, posted September 17th. Moscow didn't ravage and destroy Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, Yemen, Donbass, and other countries, or occupy any. It doesn't use terrorist mercenaries as proxy foot soldiers or wage endless wars on humanity. It's not responsible for exponentially growing human floods of desperate people fleeing war-torn areas for safe havens anywhere out of harm's way. It accepted over 1 million Ukrainian refugees fleeing Obama's war on Donbass, treating them humanely, regularly supplying Donetsk and Lugansk with badly needed humanitarian aid, doing the same thing for Syrians. Wherever America shows up, genocide, mass destruction, and human misery follow. That comes from the article, The Unspoken Truth, Obama's Responsibility to Protect the Islamic State. The objective is to degrade and destroy Iraq and Syria, by Stephen Lendman, posted September 16th. Now that the conservative government in Britain has its feet under the desk, it is preparing to enact new legislation that, under the guise of the war on terror, that will vastly expand police state powers and essentially criminalize speech and other political activity. Presented officially as an anti-terrorism bill, the proposed measures will be targeted at any popular opposition to the government's policies of aggressive militarism abroad and austerity measures in Britain, or for that matter, anything the government deems worthy of oppressing. The new bill will create extremist disruption orders for individuals and banning orders for groups. This will be used to criminalize campaigns critical of government policy and protests, which are frequently dispersed by the police on precisely the grounds that they disrupt public order. The language also indicates the government would have the authority to target those merely planning such activity prior to it taking place, and they would do that through mass surveillance. That comes from the article, Britain Moves from Democracy to Authoritarian State in Pernicious Veil of Secrecy, by Graham Van Bergen, posted September 16th, originally appearing at True Publica. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Canadian people are going to the polls on October 19th to decide on whether to reward the current national government with another mandate or to replace them with an alternative. Among the most important concerns for Canadians is the state of the Canadian economy. Are there credible efforts that can be taken at this time of low oil and commodity prices that could rebuild the Canadian economy and alleviate the burden on Canadian taxpayers? To discuss this, we have brought in Herb Wiseman. He is a longtime member of the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform, or COMER, and currently serves as the organization's information officer. It's good to have you with us, Mr. Wiseman.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can you give us some background on your group, COMER?
We were formed in 1988. The very first edition that we put out at that time made a comment that if the plan of the governor of the Bank of Canada to wrestle inflation in the ground, which I believe is a quote, was successful, we'd be lucky if the next recession wasn't as bad as the one in the 30s. And that was really the beginning of what we started talking about. We were addressing the concerns we had then about the way in which the Bank of Canada was operating.
Now, I understand that much of your recommendations revolves around the way money is created and the role of the Bank of Canada. So could you maybe give us maybe a bit of a Cole's Notes on how that whole dynamic is been playing out over the last few decades?
Well, for the sake of your listeners, it's worth noting that the way in which money is created in our economy is very poorly misunderstood, or very poorly understood, rather. If you ask most people, they'll say that money is created by the Bank of Canada or by the government. And if you say, when you go to the bank and you borrow money from the bank, where do they get it? People will very often say, oh, they get it from the other depositors or the Bank of Canada. And that's actually not true, because we have in this country what is called a fractional reserve system of banking, which means that banks are allowed to lend out many times more dollars than they actually have on deposit.
Okay.
So that's a very important thing for people to understand. And all banks, and I believe credit unions as well, have the power to create money that they can lend out. They have to have enough on hand to be able to meet the demands of customers who come in looking for cash, but cash, currency, and money are not all the same thing. So it's important to understand those distinctions, and not many people do.
So there's no requirement to make sure that when you lend out money that you actually have it on hand. It's you're essentially creating it out of thin air?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. So how does that kind of translate into the currency? Because when people pay back, like if they borrow, they have to pay back money that didn't exist earlier, and so you're getting a kind of a...
The banks are making out real well on that one.
Uh-huh. So, yeah. So you're saying that under the current situation, what we have, the whole philosophy of debt repayment, it's not about being prudent so much as a transfer to the wealthy.
Now, if we're talking about the federal debt, what we're looking at here is a change that happened. And by the way, I want to just suggest that if anybody's wanting to look at this in detail, they could go to the CBC website, and they have one of the most amazing charts there. It's interactive, where you can actually track what has happened with the debt and the deficit. And it's even got a feature to it in terms of 2015 dollars. So you can track it from 1963 to the present, and you can see what each prime minister and each government has done in terms of the debt, the deficit, and so on.
Okay.
And it's very, very revealing. The important thing about this is that when you look at that chart, it's very dramatic, because starting in the mid-70s, it starts to go straight up almost. The amount of debt, the amount of money that we owe, has increased exponentially. And if you look at all the years before that, you don't see a graph that looks the same. The graph is relatively flat from 1917 right through the Depression years, through the Second World War, into the prosperous 50s and 60s. And then in the early 70s, something changed. And suddenly the debt starts to increase dramatically. It's exponential in the way it increases.
Now, the way that's generally characterized among mainstream media and mainstream politicians is that in the 70s, under the former Prime Minister Trudeau, we were spending like drunken sailors, and that continued, and we just out of control spending. But that's really not accurate at all, is it?
No, it isn't. If you look at the spending at that time, and you look at it as a percentage of the GDP, you'll find that education, healthcare, and many other things were the same percentage of the GDP as they had always been. There's never been really much change.
So what was the critical factor that led to this skyrocketing debt?
Our belief is it's the changing in where the government borrows its money. If you look in the 70s, they stopped borrowing the same amount as they used to from the Bank of Canada, and started borrowing much more from foreigners, from offshore Wall Street places in the States and maybe Europe, and stopped the borrowing from the Bank of Canada.
Okay, well,
that's the crux of our lawsuit, in that we believe that was a mistake. If you look at the data, you'll find that prior to the mid 70s or so, about, I'm just speaking off the top of my head, but approximately 20% of the amount of money the government borrowed was from the Bank of Canada. And the other 80% was from Canadian citizens through Canada Savings Bonds and through Treasury bills to the larger people with the larger financial institutions or larger corporations or larger investors, people who have more money.
Now, the Bank of Canada is our central bank.
That's correct.
What kind of interest did they charge?
Do they charge now? They're the ones who charge prime. So at the moment, they're somewhere around 0.75%, I believe. I could be wrong, but it's somewhere around that. So that's the prime they use. That's not the prime that the private banks use.
Yeah, and the Bank of Canada would print its own money, right?
Well, the Bank of Canada is charged with actually printing our currency, but they can also create money.
Okay. So what...
And the Bank of Canada was created in 1934 by the Bank of Canada Act, was passed then. And in 1938, the Liberal government of Mackenzie King nationalized it because of pressure, I think, from the CCF at the time on the prairies, where many people were saying that the bank should be owned by the government. That when it was first formed, it was owned by the private banks, the way the Federal Reserve is in the States. And in 1938, Mackenzie King nationalized it.
Okay.
And then since then, it helped finance much of the infrastructure through the Second World War, through the building of the St. Lawrence Seaway, for example, and many other things that happened in the country.
So what was, do you have any understanding of the reasons, both official and actual, as to why the Bank of Canada's historic role was abandoned?
I'm not sure that the politicians at the time really understood what was going on. I believe I saw a quote once by Trudeau Sr., who said that if he had understood what was happening, he might have done something about it. I'm not sure that's true, but I vaguely have a memory of a quote about that. So I don't think they understood. I don't think they knew what was going on. At that time, the supply-side economic theories were becoming more and more prominent, and people like Milton Friedman were proposing these kinds of changes. He was with the University of Chicago School of Economics, I believe, and in 1976 won a Nobel Prize for some of his work in economics. And the belief system changed, and the Bank of International Settlements, which is located in Basel, Switzerland, pulled together the central bankers and apparently made some kind of an agreement, which we have not got a copy of, but it's rumored that there is an agreement that all the central banks in the world would adhere to the same kind of policy of not lending to the governments.
Now, I think I've heard some of the criticisms that I've heard of that kind of approach would revolve around the idea that if we print more money and if we borrow more borrowing, we're going to end up with much more money in the system chasing fewer products, and that's going to lead to a kind of a Zimbabwe-type situation with, you know, as more money chases fewer goods. Do you buy that at all?
No, I don't. First off, there's all kinds of controls on it. The notion around that is that it's inflationary. If you have a central bank and the government borrows from the central bank, it's in effect printing more money. I ask people, well, what's the difference between a central bank lending the government money and a private bank lending the same amount of money? And you can still keep those amounts in line with each other. You don't have to borrow more money than we are borrowing now. The main issue, and that's what's in the second article in this latest issue, the issue for me is the huge amount of interest we pay on the debt. And I've asked a lot of Canadians, how much interest do we pay on the debt? Do you know even how much the debt is currently? And two numbers really strike out for me, or really jump out at me on this one. The federal debt right now is $620 billion in this current budget. This current budget also added, apparently, almost $20 billion to the debt. The projected debt service charge or interest is $25.7 billion. That's a lot of money that's being transferred to basically well-off Canadians.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at the budget, it's the third highest item in the whole budget. The highest one is seniors, I believe. The next one is health. The third one is debt service charge. And the fourth one, lower than debt service charge, is defense. And so when you look at that number, in an environment when interest rates are very low, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that if we have prosperity and we start to do much better, interest rates are going to go up. If you listen to the news, they're always wondering if interest rates are going to go up as the economy starts to improve. And that $25.7 billion is going to go up quite dramatically, quite quickly. Now, a lovely example of that is during Martin's years when Ralph Goodale, I think, was the finance minister. At that time, the debt was $480 billion, approximately. But he paid $35 billion in interest to the well-off people in this country and outside this country in interest. So when you look at those kinds of numbers, and they don't change when they're trying to balance a budget. When they try to balance a budget, they cut all the other items or adjust all the other items, but they can never do that to the interest. Now, if the Bank of Canada held the entire $620 billion debt, and it can't do it all at once, that $25.7 billion would be returned to the government, and that's how interest-free money happens. So there's a process that you have to go through. The government can't just borrow as much money as it wants. It has to work in concert with the Bank of Canada, which is required under the law to regulate it. So the fear about inflation is a groundless one. Mm-hmm. A dollar created by the Bank of Canada, in fact, might be less inflationary than a dollar created by the private banking system because there's no interest attached to it in the same way.
Okay.
There's another factor to take into account in that interest. If we held even 25% of the debt, which is comparable to what we did prior to the 70s, we would have $6 to $7 billion in surplus easily in the budget. But the money that we now pay to the private sector, we don't know what happens to it. Some of it might get taxed. Some of it goes into pension plans, I know. How much of it goes offshore? How many people are able to avoid paying taxes on it altogether? So hardly any of it ever flows back to the government, and very little of it does anything to stimulate the economy. So that's a bit of a long answer, but in essence, it is not inflationary to borrow from the Bank of Canada,
okay,
providing you don't do it in weird and wonderful ways. If you do it the way Germany did back in the 1920s, yeah, you could run into some serious problems, but they decided to monetize their debt, which means that they printed a lot of money and paid off what they owed to other countries, or made an attempt to do that by printing more money and reducing the value of their currency and paying off a lot more in their with reduced value dollars.
Okay. Well, thank you for that very comprehensive answer. I wanted you to talk a little bit, if you could, about the state of the lawsuit. Your organization and members Ann Emmett and William Krem had launched a lawsuit through your legal representative, Rocco Galati, against the Bank of Canada.
That's correct.
And there was a victory in January of sorts.
Yes, I suppose you could call it that, yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to maybe mention a little bit about what was arrived at then and where things sit going into your next hearing date next month?
Well, they allowed us to proceed. That was the bottom line, to the next level, which is happening in October the 14th, if I remember correctly. And I'm not supposed to, as a member of the organization, to talk a lot about it. The lawyer has asked that he be the one who's contacted around that, and he will grant you interviews and stuff like that. But in essence, we won the right to proceed to court on the merits of the main claims. So we can proceed to see if we can get a declaration of the failure of the government to fulfill its constitutional responsibilities and the bank its statutory one. So we can move ahead on that. A second claim we did not win was on, it was disallowed, and it was basically harm done to the individual plaintiffs. In a sense, it was a class action suit against the Bank of Canada and the finance minister on behalf of all Canadians, and if they allowed us to proceed with that, we would then have to do an accounting of the harm that was done by the Bank of Canada not lending the money over the last 40 years to the government, and that money would then have to be paid out to all Canadians. and that part was disallowed at this time, although they did say, as I understand it, they said we could redraft and resubmit the claim relating to the harm done to individual plaintiffs. Individual plaintiffs meaning the class action, not just Ann and Bill.
Herb, I just want to maybe ask you one last question, if I might, because we're having this conversation on the heels of a leaders' debate that just took place in Calgary, and I kept hearing a mention about the need for balanced budgets, and the Liberal leader in particular talking about how interest rates are so low right now. Now is the time to invest in infrastructure and whatnot, and you know, being panned by the other two leaders. But there's no acknowledgement of this mechanism of using our own central bank. I mean, I'm sure they must be familiar with the...
Every one of them receives every month, and now every 2 months, a copy of our journal. Every politician in the country receives a copy for free.
So how do you account for their silence on this issue?
I think it's a psychological problem for them. Many of your listeners may be struggling with the idea of money being created. And I think psychologically, it creates in people a sense of cognitive dissonance when they have to start thinking about something in a new way that's contrary to the way they have been thinking about it for many years. So I think that's part of the problem. The other part of the problem would be that the forces, the power, the people who are powerful around this are also the ones who are benefiting from it. And if they started talking about this, you could bet that the media, which is by and large controlled by the same forces, would come out with very strong campaign against doing what we're suggesting. Mm-hmm. That is one of the things that's interesting, too, is that the media has, for the most part, hardly covered our lawsuit.
Yeah.
There's been an article in The Star, an interview on the CBC, and very little else. Very few media outlets have been looking at this and trying to provide the public with background data and stuff like that. And I think part of the reason is psychological, that it's difficult to get your head around this issue for people. And I think, secondly, that the very powerful certainly don't want it. There was a reason for doing it the way we did in 1938 and nationalizing the bank. And there was a major campaign that went on for many years to get rid of regulatory kinds of structures. This is seen as a regulatory kind of body in the sense that those who are wealthy and powerful do not want regulations to inhibit their situation. So I think that those are some of the factors behind it. I think there's genuine belief that on the part of some of my friends that I have conversations with, that it would be bad. It would be wrong. It can't be. We've never done it this way. They don't know the history when we have done it this way. So I think it's hard for people to get their heads around it. That's the bottom line.
Well, Mr. Wiseman, thanks to your very articulate explanations, I think that I'm hopeful that many of our listeners have been able to better wrap their minds around this. Very important to be discussing this during an election.
You may be interested in a bit of other data if I can throw something in quickly.
Quickly, if you can.
Jeremy Corbyn, who has just won the leadership of the Labour Party in England, is very much on board with these ideas. The British Parliament has actually debated the issue of having their central bank create money and lend to the government. And they, at this point, are spending over $2 billion every week interest on their debt.
Mm-hmm.
I translated their $1 billion pounds into dollars. So they're paying $1 billion a week in pounds, a billion pounds a week on the interest on their debt. And that's a huge amount of money for the wealthy to be faced perhaps losing.
Yeah. Well, at least we wouldn't even have to be pioneers then. Herb Wiseman, it's been great to have you. Thank you very much for sharing this with our listeners.
Oh, my pleasure. I hope it's helpful to people in understanding this issue.
We've been speaking with Herb Wiseman. He is the information officer for the Committee on Monetary and Economic Reform. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. For a more comprehensive examination of the role of publicly owned banks in financing public infrastructure and job creation, we now turn to an interview conducted by Berkeley-based Global Research NewsHour contributor Kellia Ramirez-Watson. This and other interviews by Kellia Ramirez-Watson are available on her website, www.patreon.com/Kellia.
Have you ever thought that banking and credit should be a public utility? Author and attorney Ellen Hodgson Brown thinks we'd all be better off if this were the case. Brown is the author of The Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free, now in its fifth edition, and From Austerity to Prosperity, The Public Bank Solution, both published by Third Millennium Press of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Brown is the founder of the Public Banking Institute, a nonprofit volunteer organization, the goal of which is to educate the public as to the existence of a so-called public option in banking. The Institute seeks to get public banks set up in each of the 49 United States that currently don't have one. Only North Dakota has one at this time. The Institute also favors cities and counties having their own local government-owned banks. I'm Kellia Ramirez-Watson. As part of our conversation, I asked Brown to define public banks.
What we mean is publicly owned banks, but it's such an awkward phrase, and public bank reads so much better. So we went with public banks, but we just have to explain what that means. We don't mean publicly listed on the stock exchange. A public bank is a bank that's owned by the government. In Germany and in Switzerland, they have lots of local banks that are owned by their local governments. So they're small banks, but they're publicly owned. And we're trying to get those set up here. We have various cities and counties that are working on that now. We have one state-owned bank. That's the Bank of North Dakota. We only have one in the whole country, but it's a wonderful model. They've got the lowest unemployment rate in the country, the lowest default rate on loans, the lowest foreclosure rate, the most local banks per capita. The Bank of North Dakota serves the local banks, helps the local banks, keeps them independent of, prevents them from being gobbled up by the big Wall Street banks. It helps with the capitalization, helps with liquidity.
And how long have they been in business in North Dakota?
Since 1919, and they return a very nice dividend to the state. So it's a big moneymaker for the state. Sometimes people say that they were set up a long time ago. It's a farming state. It's a small state. It's got oil. There are all these reasons why it wouldn't work today. So that's why I wrote The Public Bank Solution, which is my latest book, where I looked at public banking globally and historically. For example, I just wrote an article on Costa Rica. 80% of their banks are publicly owned, and they are actually commercial banks, which the Bank of North Dakota isn't. It theoretically, you could have a deposit there, but they don't really cater to small depositors. It's their main depositor is the state itself, and they leverage the state's funds into credit for the state. In Costa Rica, they actually compete with the private banks. They run circles around the private banks. I mean, the private banks just can barely survive there while the public banks are going strong, and they compete with each other. So it's not like they have a monopoly. There's four big public banks, and they compete heavily with each other to give the best rates and the best service, et cetera. So it's a really great model.
North Dakota is a small place, big geographically, but small population. Costa Rica is a small country. Do public banks have a better chance of working in small places than, let's say, Germany or the UK or the US on a federal level?
Banking works very well in Germany, and that's why Germany is doing so well.
Public banking in America is much older than the Bank of North Dakota.
The American colonies are the original public banking model, and it worked very well in Pennsylvania, which was Benjamin Franklin's colony, where the government owned a bank, a land bank it was called. Like all the colonies, they just printed their own money in the form of these little paper receipts where they acknowledged the payment of goods and services with these receipts. But in Pennsylvania, the public bank printed and lent most of the money into the economy. And so then that was paid back with interest. But because the government was the bank, they could then print and spend a little extra into the economy. So that was enough to cover the interest. So you didn't have this big pyramid scheme where you always have to pay back more than was put out there. They put out enough to make the whole system sustainable. So you didn't have to keep printing more and more money like what you have today, where all the money's created as debt. And there's always more owed back than was put out there.
Some people today, such as Germany's Dr. Margaret Kennedy, favor interest-free money. Brown sees things differently.
I think interest is all right. I'm not opposed to interest, but that would be in a public banking system where we, the people, own the banks, and therefore profits come back to the people through their government. And they're distributed for public purposes. It's credit used to develop infrastructure and create jobs, give credit to parts of the economy that need it, instead of being all about making money for the private shareholders and the private CEOs, et cetera, of big banks.
Well, it seems, and I got this also from your book, Web of Debt, that back in the colonial period and even earlier on, money wasn't a thing that had value in itself apart from the goods and services it represented. That's the problem we have now.
There was no such thing as gambling and derivatives. Well, actually, in public bank solution, I traced it all the way back to Sumeria, where they kept track on stone. They literally etched it in stone. Their accounting all involved particular things, and that's the way it was in the colonies, where the colonies were paying for things delivered to the government. But even then, it was not actually a debt of the government because the people owed. And so the idea was that you owed a certain amount in taxes, but the government would take an advance on the taxes. So they would give you a little receipt acknowledging that you had already paid a certain amount. But really, it was the people that owed the government, and they were paying in the form of goods and services.
Can you tell us how many countries have public banks? Is this a common thing?
40% of banks globally are publicly owned, shockingly. Little known to us because it's kind of concealed from our knowledge base. These are largely in the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, and China, which also house 40% of the global population. And they all escaped the credit crisis. Actually, Russia slipped a little, but then they came. I mean, they've all done quite well through what we call the credit crisis.
How many American states are thinking of it now? Public banking.
We have 20 states that have actually brought bills of one form or another.
How would it affect the economy if public banks rather than the Federal Reserve created money in the U.S.?
You would still need a central bank. You need something to backstop the whole banking system like we have now. But ideally, you would have a central bank that is owned by the government and that it responds to the will of the government. I know the concern is that then it will be corrupted by politicians. But I actually had this discussion with the man in Costa Rica who told me about their great banking system, which was the first I learned about it, that they're totally transparent. Their public banks are totally transparent and totally accountable, and that's the difference. You need a democratic government, and you need a transparent and accountable system. That means that at the very least, our Federal Reserve should be audited. They want to be independent and be secret. Well, that's a recipe for corruption.
Remind me again why people thought that the monetary policy of the United States should be apart and independent from the fiscal policy that is under the Treasury.
In the 1970s, we had inflation globally, and it was blamed on governments printing their own money or borrowing from their own central banks, which printed the money, and that was considered to be inflationary. But actually, the countries that had that policy, like Canada, they didn't have inflation. In Canada, they didn't have inflation for 30 years when they were borrowing directly from their own bank, which created the money. to build roads and seaways and fund all sorts of development, and they funded their great healthcare system. It was really great then. It's fallen off now because they've cut back on what government is allowed to fund. So what really caused the inflation, according to Bill Engdahl in one of his books, was that when the dollar went off the gold standard in 1971, then the dollar was plunging in global markets. And so all these big financiers got together and met in Sweden in 1973, along with Henry Kissinger. And they decided that they would back the dollar with oil. So Kissinger and Nixon made a deal. They talked to the Shah of Iran, and then they made a deal with OPEC countries that oil would be sold only in dollars, and the dollars would be deposited in London and Wall Street banks. And in return, Henry Kissinger would see that the oil price shot up, that it would be quadrupled. And it actually was quadrupled after that because of that little 9 days war, which resulted in a boycott, which drove oil prices up. So that meant all these countries that thought they had enough dollars to buy oil suddenly didn't.
That was another Arab-Israeli war that we had in 73?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
So it was a short war, but it was sufficient to drive oil prices up by a factor of 4, which meant all these countries that thought they had enough money to buy the oil they needed suddenly didn't, because the price had quadrupled. So they had to borrow from Wall Street, and so that was the beginning of their debt crises. And then interest rates in 1980, they were driven up to 20%, or in Costa Rica, for example, they went as high as 27%. And that was an intentional rise by Fed Chairman Paul Volcker. The theory was that if you raise interest rates, you'll stop inflation. It was supposed to be a counterinflationary measure. But in fact, it doesn't work that way. And if you look at charts, if interest rates go up, then everybody has to raise their prices to cover this new cost of interest. So it actually causes prices to go up. But that was the alleged reason for this interest rate rise.
Allegedly, they would tamp down the economic activity and that would lower inflation.
Right. People wouldn't borrow so much because it would cost too much to borrow. But what it did do was it trapped all these third world countries hopelessly in debt. Everybody was buying their oil from the U.S., so everybody was in debt to us. So it worked in that sense. The dollar retained its status as global reserve currency, but it was very hard on all these other countries.
Everything we've been talking about just sounds like a plan to transfer wealth from as many people and nations as possible to a few corporate and political types around the world.
Right, and it's worked pretty well.
Mm-hmm. So what about the mortgage crisis? Would public banks securitize mortgages the same way private banks are doing now?
No, we only have one model in the U.S., but we have the Bank of North Dakota. And in North Dakota, the banks did not fall into this securitization and derivatives and MERS and all that whole scheme.
What does MERS stand for? And what impact does it have on American home foreclosures?
MERS is the Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems. It's an electronic database. More than half of the mortgages in the country are held in the name of MERS. So it's supposedly an agent of the real owners of these mortgages, but it actually conceals who the real owners are. And because of MERS, the whole securitization model is enabled to operate. So you never know who the owners are. The owners can change hands. They can buy and sell bits and pieces of many houses all at once. Securities, which are composed of mortgages bundled up in these huge packages and then chopped up into various tranches or slices, depending on their appetite for risk. So it basically defeats the real estate laws of local governments. Every time a piece of real estate changes hands, in order to make that formal and legal, you're supposed to record it at the recording office. Now it's all recorded in the name of MERS. So It conceals a lot of fraud. The homeowners who are trying to do a workout on their mortgages, for example, they don't know who to negotiate with, and the banks don't tell them. The banks say, well, we're not the real parties in interest. We're not authorized, and whoever is authorized isn't even contacted, so they didn't even know that you're trying to negotiate with them. You know, the reason that banks were selling off their mortgages was that because of this 10% capital requirement that was imposed by the Bank for International Settlements starting in 1969, that was that same whole thing of the Bank for International Settlements getting control of the banking system. But they imposed this capital requirement. So before, it was just a reserve requirement, which meant you had to hold back a certain amount of your deposits. But with the capital requirement, you had to have a certain amount of your own money. You, the bank, had to put up 10% of your own money to back. So the bank would have a certain amount of capital, and then it could make X amount, Y amount in loans. And then it would just have to sit on those loans for 30 years before it could make any more money. It would have to wait for them to be paid off unless it was able to raise its capital base. But if they sold their loans off to investors, then they could keep churning loans, you know, taking on more loans, charging fees, et cetera, making money in the business of generating loans, and then selling those off to investors. So that's how they got around the capital requirement.
I've heard of a report that said banks today make 53% of their revenues in fees.
Yeah, and wow, I can well believe that, yeah.
Would public banks be interested in lowering the principal of underwater mortgages where the borrower owes more than the property is worth?
Well, there are cities that are talking about doing eminent domain, which I think is a good idea, but that, you know, where they'll take these properties by eminent domain and they'll work it out with the homeowners, so they'll refinance at market value. And then the investors, of course, are going to lose out, and the investors aren't too happy about that. So the problem is the banks are threatening that they won't be doing mortgages in those cities if the cities try that, that it's unconstitutional, et cetera. But if they did it through a bank, say they set up their own city-owned bank, and then they said, we are going to take these properties by eminent domain. It was a land bank. You know, they have land banks already that are in different states. They're not depository banks. They're called land banks, and their purpose is to deal with these foreclosed properties. So you just said, we're going to put them in our land bank. We're taking these properties because it's for the good of the community. And if anybody can prove title, then we'll pay fair market value. And if they only focus on the ones with MERS in the title and these obvious defects that the courts are now holding, like that Glaske case where the courts are holding that this is a defect in the chain of title. And if you can't fix that defect, you aren't entitled to foreclose. So if they focus only on those properties, which is 90% of the properties, they shouldn't have trouble doing that. And they say, anybody that can prove title will do the fair thing. But first you have to prove title. And then they only take the properties where title can't be proved, which is going to be 90% of them. Then they could get a lot of title free and clear. They're not going to run up against this challenge like, well, we're not going to make loans in your neighborhood anymore because you've, whatever, taken our property unfairly or something, because they haven't taken it unfairly. It's perfectly legal if the banks can't prove title.
Yeah, they're trying that in Richmond, California right now, which is just up the road from me.
Very bold.
I just saw a bit of a story. I haven't had time to read it yet, that said that the banks want to keep this issue of eminent domain in Richmond because then they can kind of tamp it down and keep it quiet. But the idea is spreading to other cities that are now thinking of it. So the banks look like they're going to have their hands full if a number of cities want to do this. What, if anything, would be the effect of public banking on the derivatives market?
Well, in North Dakota, they just don't do derivatives. They say if we don't understand it, we don't do it. I mean, they just do old-fashioned conservative banking. There's no profit in it to the bankers. They are civil servants. They get paid a salary. They do not get bonuses, fees, or commissions. They don't get anything extra for churning loans. And they don't get to gamble with other people's money. They just work for the state. So they get promoted on the basis of doing a good job for the local economy, doing what's good for the local economy, doing what's good for their customers, et cetera. So it's just old-fashioned banking.
And if public banks operated alongside private banks, would they be involved in either bailouts or bail-ins, public banks?
No. A public bank is owned by the government, whether federal, state, or local. So the government itself, they're not going to get into a situation where they're going to need a bailout. The government is the bank. They pay their own debts. To start with, we only really need one per state. But you could envision all sorts of improvements by making banking in general a public utility, as it is in some other countries.
Now, we know that these banksters that we've been talking about are corrupt, and so are the politicians that they've bought. What are the chances that a public banking system can be corrupted?
Well, that's why we need total transparency and total accountability. Then it won't be. And the Bank of North Dakota is audited several different ways, and it's very transparent. Anybody who wants to can see what they're up to. And that's the way it is in Costa Rica as well. Of course, they don't reveal private deposits, but above the level of private accounts, they're completely transparent. In other words, what the bank itself is doing is totally transparent. And now with the internet, it seems to me it is a whole new day in potential transparency. And you can see where 50 years ago, a government could easily, politicians could get in there and manipulate the bank, and nobody would know what they were up to because they just didn't have access. But now we do. We have anybody who wants to can look on the internet and see what's going on, if it's a requirement of the bank that they post all those figures on the net.
Your Web of Debt website says that public banking is important to capitalism. Given that you've read and researched and written so much about what is wrong with capitalism, why are you interested in preserving it rather than seeing public banking as a transition to something else?
Well, I think capitalism just means competition. Our original American model of many little farmers competing with each other was a good thing. But now you don't have many little farmers. You have great big agricultural monopolies, great big banking monopolies, and they call that capitalism, but it isn't capitalism. What I would envision is half public, half private, which is actually what we have now. According to James Galbraith, the American economy is 50% public. It's just a question of what you put in the public sector. And right now, what's in the public sector is largely the military. I mean, they eat up the vast majority of the public sector. In Costa Rica, they don't even have a military. They also have something that's a little less than half public. But the half that's public goes to 30% goes to medical and education. Think of it, if 30% of our economy went to medical and education. What a great...
With the expense of American healthcare, though, it's looking like 30% of our GDP is going...
there anyway.
No,
sorry, I meant 30% of the government budget.
The GDP is gross domestic product, a quarterly or yearly measure of the value of all goods and services a country produces.
But they have the money to do that. And they still have, they're booming, their economy's booming, and it's been booming ever since 1949 when they switched over to this. I mean, it started then, where they, at first it was a totally socialized system. Well, anyway, they called it socialism, but they still had lots of private businesses. But the private businesses are the little ones, in other words, that small mom and pop things that compete with each other. That's a really good thing to continue to have. Yeah, I saw that in Russia now, they are giving away plots of land to several acres to anybody who wants them in order to do gardening on these plots. So most of their agriculture is done organically by little private farmers. So that is the original capitalist model, where you have all these little farmers competing with each other. And they've done it in a socialist way. In other words, this government that owns a lot of land is giving away the land to individual private operators, just like we did at the beginning of the colonial period, where people could go out and homestead and stake out a plot of land and grow their own food and raise animals and be self-sufficient and trade products fairly in a fair capitalist system.
Anything else?
Ideally, I would see banking as a public utility, period. I mean, it seems to me that credit is like water and electricity. It's something that everybody needs, and it's the lifeblood of the economy, and you don't want to have private tourniquets on this lifeblood. It should be under public control, totally transparent, totally accountable. But I know it'll be a long time getting there. In the meantime, to get there, it seems to me we don't have control over our federal government at all. They're deadlocked. It's very hard to get them to do anything. But we do have control, or we can make some waves with our local governments. Those are people that are still responsive. A handful of commissioners can make decisions like setting up a bank in smaller counties. So there still is potential there for setting up little local models of what it would be like if we had a public utility that was our banking system, or public credit, credit as a public utility in a small system, and just see how well that works. And I think once that has been demonstrated on a local level, that it'll just be so obvious that it's better. In California, in the last 7 years, the public school system has borrowed $9 billion, and in 30 years, they will have to pay $36 billion to pay this back. They're going to pay four times what they borrowed in order to pay off these loans, because that's the only way the school systems can get funding these days. If you had a public bank, you could get that interest free.
Could these small cities and even counties that are in such fiscal crisis now feel like they have the wherewithal to set up a bank?
They could, because it doesn't take that much to capitalize a bank to start with. In fact, all you need to do is put your own revenues in the bank to start with. You don't even have to make loans. Just put your revenues in this bank. You don't need the capital until you start making loans. And then you can make loans bit by bit. And as that generates revenues and you expand your economy, then you can expand your capital base.
And this method would be good all over the world. Ireland could do it. Iceland could do it. Germany could do it.
Right. And they are doing it in many places. We just aren't aware of it.
You've been listening to Ellen Hodgson Brown, founder of the Public Banking Institute. She's also the author of The Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System and How We Can Break Free, now in its fifth edition, and From Austerity to Prosperity, The Public Bank Solution, both published by Third Millennium Press of Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Brown's websites are www.webofdebt.com and www.publicbanksolution.com. You can learn more about public banking at publicbankinginstitute.org. No triple W with that one. I'm Kelia Ramirez Watson in Berkeley, California.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. Many thanks to this week's guest contributor, Berkeley, California-based Kelia Ramirez Watson. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.